This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are exposed. And in this new series, we investigate the dark side of the wellness industry, following the story of a woman who joined a yoga school only to uncover a world she never expected.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this.
Where the hope of spiritual breakthroughs leaves people vulnerable to exploitation.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
World of Secrets, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The fall of the Assad regime in Syria has triggered the start of possibly the greatest reshaping of the Middle East in decades, one that could see deadly enemies join the same side.
Все, что происходит в Сирии, как поражение России, это не так. Мы поддерживаем отношения со всеми группировками. Наши интересы должны совпадать. Что мы сможем для них сделать?
When Vladimir Putin spoke about events in Syria for the first time, he said it wasn't a defeat for Russia and explained that the interests of the Kremlin and its former foes, the rebels, might align.
Russian geopolitical and international rhetoric is very malleable when it comes to regimes that may not have full international support. And where Russia sees a potential ally, Russia is ready to make a deal.
Center stage is a man little known until recently, the self-styled reformed jihadi with a nom de guerre, Abu Mohammed al-Jolani. He seems to be a man with a plan.
One sign that may indicate that Jolani wants to have a constructive relationship with Russia is there were reports that a convoy of vehicles traveling from Damascus carrying Russian diplomats and perhaps troops to the Russian bases there, and HTS provided protection to the convoy.
President Assad's regime survived a brutal civil war thanks to Russian and Iranian military support against the rebel challengers. Assad is now in Moscow, and the country his family ruled for more than 50 years is facing a daunting transition. But just as Russia was vital for Syria, Damascus gave Moscow a springboard for its foreign missions elsewhere, which has now been thrown into uncertainty. In this episode, we explore Moscow's options and what the potential loss of the Syrian military bases could mean for its strategic footprint in Africa. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Crassie Tweek, and this is the Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring, where we look at the world through the lens of its media, getting past the narratives, the propaganda, and the disinformation.
Radio Tehran.
Мы не вторгались на территорию Украины.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
조종 두 당 두 나라 최고 영도자 동지들께서는.
Before we dive into the subject of Russia's military bases in Syria, let's check the temperature on both sides with our trusted media weather vane. Our colleagues who've been monitoring Syrian media for decades were presented with a sight to behold. Samia Hosni from our Middle East team couldn't believe her eyes when the rebels, led by Jolani's HTS group, took over state TV.
State-run TV, which was the mouthpiece for the Assad regime, of course, is now controlled by the new rulers before the collapse of the regime. Hours and hours of news coverage supportive of Assad, as expected. Then suddenly, the morning the rebels took over Damascus, presenter appeared on air with the three-starred flag of the revolution, and that was used by the rebels, draped on his desk. And you could see it on TV just like that, and interspersed with pro-rebel anthems and songs. And then we saw a statement announcing victory over tyranny. The change was so drastic, literally overnight. And you saw the change in tone, the change in coverage. And we saw cordial exchanges between the presenter and an HTS official sitting and talking about the Mujahideen. I suppose because probably they are in the process of putting in new programming and a new structure. So they're using some of the presenters. Focus on celebrations across Syria. And also, most of the time you see statements and instructions issued by the interim government calling on state employees to go back to work, statements that call for people to respect rights of minorities, to protect people. The new interim authority is actually trying to give the impression that it's business as usual. We are now on track towards the rebuilding of Syria.
Naturally, the domestic situation would be a priority for the new authorities, but do they give any hints at all about any geopolitical orientations, anything about other countries, Russia?
During the offensive, actually, when Russian warplanes were bombing rebel targets, the rebel authority issued a statement condemning the Syrian army, but did not mention Russia by name. And then there were actually also statements issued in Arabic and Russian on Telegram saying, if Moscow ceases backing Assad, then the rebels will be prepared to work constructively with Russia. Jolani made statements. He said, we could have bombed the Russian bases, but we chose not to. We gave Russia a chance to rebuild its ties with us. Come and sit and let's negotiate.
When you think of Jolani's overtures to his former enemy, remember that during the military intervention, the Russian Air Force carried out more than 100,000 combat sorties in the skies of Syria. We know that from a Russian Air Force commander there, Yevgeny Nikiforov. Russian forces have killed an estimated 7,000 civilians in Syria up to June last year, according to the Syrian Network for Human Rights. Jolani has indicated he is willing to put it all behind him. What signals do we get from the other side? Gleb Burshevsky observes Russia and its military ambitions for BBC Monitoring from Tbilisi.
Traditional media are all citing the Kremlin as saying that right now the Russian authorities are in talk with what they call the interim government. Social media reports, particularly by Russian military bloggers, say that apparently Russia is pulling all of its troops from throughout Syria to Khmeimim and Tartus.
Let's introduce another colleague from our Tbilisi bureau who can bring us the Russian media coverage of these dramatic events in granular detail. Veronika Malinboim.
When the offensive started, the reports were really limited to sort of factual updates. As soon as Russian aviation began assisting Syrian army with aerial strikes on rebels, the news programs would also focus on the alleged success of such missions, and they began searching for a Ukrainian trace. And this was a narrative that was pushed for a little while with an alleged interview of who they claimed was a former member of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, allegedly confessing to being trained by Ukrainian instructors on how to operate drones. We saw a similar narrative on Russian talk shows.
Russia is now actively changing its stance toward the interim authorities in Syria. There is a rather funny anecdote.
The weekly news summary within the same program aired in two different places of Russia. The program host, Dmitry Kiselov, when addressing his audience in the Far East, described the rebels as militants from terrorist groups.
Then in the evening, this very same report was edited in the European part of Russia, say, rebel forces or the new authorities of Syria. So Russia changed its stance effectively just in less than 24 hours.
The early hours of Russian TV coverage after the fall of the Assad regime were particularly dynamic, as no one was quite sure which way things were going. And there was a revealing sense of urgency in offering face-saving explanations.
There is a naval exercise in the Mediterranean. Maybe your satellite images took this for something different.
Talk shows began blaming Assad for his own demise, saying that Russia helped him secure his victory and he had to deal with that victory better.
Выполнили поставленную перед ними задачу, обеспечили победу.
The most prominent narrative that Russia has fulfilled its responsibilities to Syria and never promised to fight for Syrians. I think we've heard it from Solovyov himself. He mentioned something along the lines of, we were happy to assist in the fight against international terrorism, which is a pretext under which Russia intervened in Syrian conflict in 2015. But we never promised to fight for them, especially if they're unwilling to fight themselves. This is one very strong line that a lot of commentators use.
More strong lines emerged from the battlefield that we cannot broadcast in full. Here's a clip with running commentary said to be by a Russian convoy driving by surrendering Syrian soldiers.
We actually saw Kremlin bots on social media allegedly trying to convince Russians that they don't really need Syria, actually. So I would say it's another interesting face-saving measure. We saw some commentators accusing Turkish leader Erdogan of backstabbing Russia, of opening a second front.
What's the take of other prominent figures?
Dmitry Kisilov stated that Moscow has always been focused on internal reconciliation. Not everyone shared this tone. For instance, Russia's ultra nationalist philosopher, who is also often dubbed as Putin's ideologist, Alexander Dugin, he described the crisis in Syria as a blow to Russia, which is quite rare to hear from a pro-Kremlin commentator.
We voiced up a few quotes from him.
I would say this is a huge loss. If Russia appears too weak and too unstable to assure its own regional interests and those of its allies, this could send the wrong message to Trump, leading him down the wrong path of treating Russia as some secondary regional power. I believe this is the plan behind the entire Syria situation.
My personal favorite is a comment by Margarita Simayan, chief editor of Russia's state RT. She accused Assad of being too self-absorbed from being in power for too long. And compare him to Putin, who is always very modest. Even when he talks about the success of his government, he never attributes it to himself, and he says that it's our achievement as opposed to his own.
And Nika, you're a specialist in the Middle East. Can you give us a little bit of the history of the Russian-Syrian military cooperation? Because it goes back way before this war.
The main interest for Soviet Union with Syria was, of course, the establishment of its influence in the region and gaining a foothold in the Mediterranean. So in 1971, under an agreement with President Hafez al-Assad, Soviet Union opened its naval military base in Tartus, and it was used to counterbalance a U.S. force.
And within a few hours, it was announced that the heads of state had signed in the Kremlin a treaty of friendship and cooperation between
Syria and Soviet Union signed a treaty of friendship. And the relationship went upward from there, I would say, because in 2005, Russia wrote off 73% of Syria's debt to Soviet Union and resumed its arms supplies. Also reinstated talks about the Tartus base. And then we approached the civil conflict in Syria.
The regime of Bashar al-Assad, Russia, Iran, and their affiliated militia are the ones responsible for what the UN called a complete meltdown of humanity. And they are showing no mercy.
2011, 2012, Russia used its power to veto United Nations resolutions that provided for sanctions against al-Assad. And in 2015, Russia began a military intervention in the Syrian civil war. That concluded in 2017 when Vladimir Putin announced the withdrawal of Russian troops from Syria. And that was done at the Khmeimim air base.
В добрый путь. Благодарю вас за службу.
the Tartus naval base and the Khmeimim air base are of huge importance to Russia. Gleb will explain later why. But there's more to Russia's military presence in Syria that's not so widely known. Samia again.
Alongside the two main bases, Russia has a network of outposts, garrisons and military police across Syria in areas that were previously controlled by Assad. They have actually just evacuated their post in Qamishli Airport. Literally, it's 5 kilometers from a U.S. base in the same area. And you can imagine the front lines in Syria and all kind of forces just meeting and avoiding each other. They also have observation posts on the Golan Heights. In November, the deputy commander of the Russian forces on state TV said, "We are building 9 new posts near the demilitarized zone, not far from the Israeli-occupied part of the Golan Heights." And he would conduct surveillance operations by land and air. Moscow was trying to de-escalate the conflict between Hezbollah and the Iran-backed militias in Israel. And Russia was seen as a mediating between rebel factions and the Syrian government. Russia has been actually brokering deals all the time between rebels and Assad. There were reports that Russia is trying to encourage Assad to distance himself from Iran.
Clearly a close relationship between those two countries. How about the relationship between their leaders, Putin and Assad? What can be said about that?
It was Putin who called the shots. It was Russian military intervention in 2015 that saved Assad. It was Russian air support that shored him up and saved his regime. Putin often showed contempt for Assad during Putin's visit to the Khmeimim base in 2017. The video shows Assad hurryingly walking behind Putin. And then suddenly you see that soldier stopping Assad, pulling him by the arm and preventing him from catching up with Putin, which was very telling. I think it wasn't a warm relationship. Putin was the one who's boss. He visited the base, but didn't stop in Damascus.
We can only judge from what we see in the footage from their official meetings. I'm no expert in body language, but Putin being way more friendly with even Western leaders. So, yeah, I really doubt that there is any particular friendship going on there.
You don't reckon they'll be hanging out in Moscow together?
Not by the looks of it, no. The Kremlin says that Putin has no plans of meeting Assad anytime soon. But just judging by what we see from some leaked reports, I think Assad will find things to do in Moscow without meeting Putin. The Financial Times reports that they own 18 or 19 apartments in the Moscow city, which is a skyscraper complex in the city center. A lot of pretty glass, glamorous towers where people can buy extremely overpriced apartments. There have been reports that Assad's eldest son was studying in Moscow State University. He was obtaining his PhD on the day that rebels entered Aleppo.
You are listening to The Global Jigsaw
from BBC Monitoring.
Samia spoke about Russia's military network throughout Syria. Back to Gleb now to tell us what's been happening to it since the rebels took charge.
Russia operated a network of so-called observation posts, which are basically military police garrisons that patrolled the roads and the contested areas in Syria. It also had garrisons at various energy infrastructure facilities, oil fields. And now most, if not all, of those troops stationed throughout the country are being pulled to Khmeimim and Tartus. It is not quite clear what is happening to those troops when they are there. It might be just overflowing with all of those soldiers. Or it could be that Russia is now planning to withdraw the troops that it had elsewhere in the country.
How many troops are we talking about?
One estimate that I've seen is that there are a total of 7,500 people, Russians, in Syria. But that includes non-combat personnel as well. As for combat personnel, I think the latest estimate was up to 2,000 or so.
Now back to our main question. Why are the Tartus and Khmeimim bases important for Russia?
In the times of the Russian Empire, and I do feel like Vladimir Putin now, given one of his infamous history lessons, hundreds of years ago, Russia did not have access to what it calls warm water ports. It only had access to ports in the north, which would freeze over in the winter. This is why the Russian Empire conquered Crimea hundreds of years ago. These days, the issue is not quite as prevalent because Russia is growing its icebreaker fleet. Those ports can now be operated in the winter as well. But still, southern ports are strategically important because it is cheaper to operate them than to operate an additional fleet of icebreakers. And because they simply provide exits to different seas and different oceans.
When it comes to Russia's vested interest, those two bases, has anybody been talking about what the loss of these bases could mean for Russia and its operation in Africa?
They're not talking about the potential loss of these bases.
Officials are either saying that the future remains unknown and talks are ongoing. We've seen a lot of comments from pro-war commentators online, though, and they were panicked how dangerous and detrimental it could be to Russia's operations in Africa, how unfortunate it would be to lose everything. Mikhail Zbinchuk stated on his Rebar channel that the flow of acid will also complicate Russia's ongoing operations in Africa because Khmeimim Air Base was used as a supply route to support those operations in Sahel.
And how popular is this channel, Rebar?
I believe it's over 1 million subscribers now.
Gleb explained the importance of Tartus as a warm water port, and there are other reasons why Russia is attached to it.
The task force that is stationed there is only about a dozen warships strong, which is not a very large number compared to Russia's other fleets. But what is important about Tartus is that it flanks Turkey, one of NATO's southernmost member states, and it serves to project Russian influence outside of the NATO half-circle around the European part of Russia. It is one of the very few bases Russia operates that are outside of Russia itself. And it also effectively extends the range of Russian ship-based weapons.
No other base can provide Russia with a permanent military presence in the Mediterranean because after the start of Russia's war in Ukraine, Turkey, citing Montreal Convention, closed the Bosphorus Strait for Russian warships. So there is no way that Russian ships from the Black Sea can reach the Mediterranean, which would be the closest fleet to reach it. So if we take Russia's naval bases, Kronstadt, where the Baltic fleet is based, from there ships would have to go via the Baltic Sea, North Atlantic, and Gibraltar. If we take Vladivostok, which is where the Pacific fleet is based, then those ships would have to travel through the Pacific Ocean, then Indian Ocean, then Red Sea and Suez Channel, if they're allowed to pass through. If not, then they would have to sail around Africa. And then the Northern Fleet, which would be, for instance, Murmansk Naval Base, then the ships would have to travel through the Arctic Ocean, Northern Atlantic, and Gibraltar again. So all very, very long journeys. After which, I would assume, ships would have to undergo some sort of maintenance as well. All very expensive and all much more complicated than just having a permanent base from where you can conduct drills whenever you feel like it. Russian ships that are currently based in Tartus, they can return back to the Black Sea under the Montreal Convention. They can travel back to their home bases, but in doing that, they would risk coming under strikes from Ukraine. So this is another risk factor. Russia's Black Sea fleet is already depleted.
Tartus is clearly important, but it is the Khmeimim air base that is the vital military asset for Russia. Again, if you look at the map, you'll understand why.
Khmeimim serves as a major logistical hub for Russian operations, not only in the Middle East, but probably more importantly in Africa. Russian military aircraft making the way from Russia to Africa have to make a stop somewhere to refuel and resupply. And currently they make this stop in Khmeimim.
There were reports that Khmeimim Air Base was used by Wagner soldiers to travel to Africa as well. According to some sources, Khmeimim was also used to facilitate and organize Assad's escape to Moscow.
Russia has two main strategic aircraft that it can use to transport military personnel and hardware between continents. These are the Il-76 and the N-124. These are both older Soviet aircraft, essentially. Russia operates, according to open source information, somewhere around 200 Il-76s and about a dozen N-124s. The optimal range, when they are loaded to like 80% or so capacity, is around 5,000 kilometers. The southernmost Russian base known to host Il-76 aircraft in particular is the Taganrog Air Base. The distance to, for example, Niamey, where an Il-76 aircraft landed earlier this year, is about 5,000 kilometers, which is just about the range of the aircraft. But there needs to be some fuel in reserve. What if the landing strip is not available and it needs to land elsewhere? The aircraft needs to have like 15 to 25% fuel in the tank at landing, ideally. This would render this trip technically possible, but incredibly risky, which is why Russia does need a refueling station somewhere in between. And this is the role that Khmeimim serves.
Now, some experts suggest that cargo planes like Il-76 and N-124 can reach Libya even when fully loaded if they depart from southern Russia, but they would have to pass through Turkish airspace. That, of course, would require Turkish approval, and that would require Moscow to kind of swallow its pride and ask. And interestingly, we've seen reports lately of Turkey denying that it has given permission for overflight for an aircraft carrying Assad out of Syria and into Moscow.
There's another side to Khmeimim that's not well known. It can act as a reserve bench for Russian generals who need to stay out of sight for a while.
One more advantage of the Khmeimim airbase is that it seems to have been a place for failed Russian generals to remain in the office, continue their careers. So when the offensive first started, a lot of Russian military bloggers were saying exactly that, but they also mentioned that Russian forces were so disorganized because generals that ended up in Syria were generals that failed to prove themselves at the battlefield in Ukraine and were sent off to Syria to continue their careers in quiet. I think they mentioned General Kisiel and General Chaiko in particular.
General Chaiko's name might ring a bell. A Human Rights Watch report alleged that he was responsible for attacks in rebel-held Idlib province, Jolani's heartland. His name came up again in Ukraine, his troops combing through Bucha, among other places. Back to Khmeimim, and a bit of a mystery, even for Wagner nerds, how the group manages to find a way to Africa without the help of the base in Syria.
One of the first forces that started to deploy to Syria back then was the Wagner Group, the infamous Russian mercenary company. Back then, Wagner operated in Syria to establish control over Syrian oil fields and to fight back against what was then the Syrian rebel force. Wagner focuses on operations in Africa. What is curious is that we are not 100% sure how Wagner forces actually get to Africa, because they were kicked out of Syria and they were kicked out of Libya. They may have reached some form of agreement where they still use Syria, or they might have some other route to the continent that we simply do not know about.
This is all about Africa. So let's turn to another colleague to explain the growing Russian influence on the continent in recent years. Carney Sharp is from the BBC World Service Africa desk.
Russian military presence via Wagner and the legacy groups, among them Africa Corps, has established operations in several African countries since 2017. It has often provided security services and paramilitary assistance and launched disinformation campaigns for troubled regimes. This is in exchange for resources and also diplomatic support. The group is most active in the Central African Republic, or CAR, Mali, have also been seen in Chad, Africa Corps, active in Niger, Burkina Faso. They all share a very fragile relationship with the West due to colonial legacies and inherent political differences. Now, despite Wagner's claims that it brings stability to the areas it operates in, experts say acts more as a destabilizing force in these countries. In terms of what Russia's doing there, they're also to protect their business interests when it comes to the mines where these natural resources are coming from. So Russian forces will act on their behalf to make sure that these mines or fields are protected.
Russia is standing on the shoulders of its predecessor, the Soviet Union, which had cultivated close links with select African countries during the Cold War.
While African governments have increasingly welcomed economic, diplomatic and security ties with Russia, remember, Russia also shares a very old friendship with the continent with regards to its ties during the communist era in countries like the CAR, for example, Mozambique and Angola, even South Africa. And links with South Africa particularly were there during the apartheid regime, forming an alliance with the African National Congress, Russia did, against the apartheid government. This is why countries like South Africa find it easy to keep this age-old friendship.
Мы констатировали поступательное развитие российско-южноафриканских отношений.
And Russian influence has been growing in recent years, wielding influence in around 16 African countries and thus placing Africa at the center of a growing geopolitical contest between the Kremlin and Western governments. Analysts say this shift can be attributed to long-standing frustration with the failure of Western intervention and, for many African countries, resentment over lack of representation, for example, in international institutions. Also, it stems from a growing desire to avoid choosing sides between major powers, a mindset many Africans see as a relic of the Cold War era. Some analysts say that Moscow's increasing ambitions to position itself as an ally to African countries and stoke anti-Western sentiment could turn the continent into a flashpoint in the global strategic competition between Russia and the West. They warn that Russia's support of authoritarian governments, including its backing of a string of coups in recent years, is undermining Africa's democratic aspirations. Yet Russia's help usually comes with no democratic or human rights strings attached.
If Russia was to lose Khmeimim, it would need to find a suitable alternative in order to continue to offer its services to Africa. What could that alternative be? Gleb might have a new word for your vocabulary.
Libya, in particular, has been eyed as a sort of plan B or backup option. The diarchy in Libya makes it quite problematic. And the distance to Tobruk still makes it a much less desirable location for the Russian military.
Diarchy is a form of governance with two rulers, and that's relevant for our story because only one of them is friendly to Russia.
Libya, where Russia reportedly already has bases, they are kind of on loan-ish from the commander of the Libyan National Army, Khalifa Haftar. But he only controls part of the country. And to have a permanent base, I think that would require a formal agreement, which is not something that a person who only controls part of the country can provide. I think establishing a permanent Russian base in Libya would also increase Western pressure on Haftar, and I'm not sure that he's up for that. So I don't think that this is a realistic alternative just yet. Some experts talk about Algeria and Egypt, but I don't think that neither Algeria nor Egypt will sacrifice their neutral status to support Russia.
As for Sudan, there is an ongoing civil war in the country, so there is a very low likelihood that Russia could deploy a military base there.
Without the Tartus naval base and Khmeimim airport, analysts said that Putin
can still operate in Africa, but it becomes far more difficult to resupply and support the estimated 20,000 Africa Corps mercenaries operating there, mainly in Libya, Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. Russia is planning to build a logistical support center on Sudan's Red Sea coast to secure a Russian naval base in Sudan. Now, back in 2017, Russia's President Vladimir Putin and Sudan's former dictator, Omar al-Bashir, agreed to a Red Sea base capable of stationing Russian service members and ships in exchange for various kinds of military and security support. So it's the same sort of relationship. The Kremlin never gives up. What we're hearing, but we can't actually verify, that these talks have recently resumed.
It seems Russia's hands are somewhat tight. The fate of its Syria bases is not settled, and a desirable outcome would require a certain amount of flexibility from the Kremlin.
These rebels that Russia has been fighting for a decade, Russia is now calling the new authorities, the people in charge in Syria, and Russia is now holding talks with them. This is very reminiscent of the Taliban, which Russia is now proclaiming to be not a terrorist organization, which some Russian officials have described as sensible people. Russian geopolitical and international rhetoric is very malleable when it comes to regimes that may not have full international support, but that seek to have some form of ally on the global arena. And where Russia sees a potential ally, Russia is ready to make a deal.
Given how valuable these two bases are for Russia and hard, if not impossible, to replace, it seems that Russia might have to work with the new authorities in Syria. And that's tricky because it means making friends with the people they used to bomb all these years. What aces does Russia have up its sleeves to convince the new Damascus authorities to stay friendly?
Number one, just like with the Taliban, Russia could acknowledge the new authorities in Syria as partners, establish diplomatic ties. Having a major world power acknowledge you as a legitimate authority in a country where you have just won the civil war would be a very important thing for this new fledgling government. Number two, Russia is a known arms dealer and could offer some very lucrative arms deals to new Syrian authorities. Number three, Israel has seized a part of the demilitarized zone in the Golan Heights. Russia could serve as a counterweight slash mediator to Israel in the region.
Another sort of point of negotiations could be the wheat supply, which is an interesting topic because we have already seen none other than head of Russia's Chechen Republic, Ramzan Kadyrov, reassuring the interim authorities that Russia would continue supplying wheat to Syria and is going to prevent and make sure that humanitarian crisis doesn't occur. I think interim authorities could also see their benefit in Russia's presence in Syria as a counterbalance to Israel and the West. We see a lot of commentators doubting that Russia will be able to maintain its full force at the bases. They think that maybe what they will agree to is a face-saving measure of just maintaining a formal presence. Many worry that powers that Russia helped bomb for 9 years, they will not be all that eager to accommodate Russia's full military presence in Syria.
If Zulani is to continue his pragmatic approach and is kind of moving away from his jihadist origins towards the outside world, including Russia, I would say that they might try to have a deal. You give us international legitimacy and cooperation, and we give you some sort of leeway, some sort of presence in Syria.
So it's all up in the air, but it's clear that Russia is important for Jolani.
It's clear. And some pundits were saying in Arab media that HTS needs Russia as much as Russia needs HTS. HTS might be able in the next few weeks to formalize ties with regional powers like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, but it needs international legitimacy. And Russia could provide that. Many Arab countries have very strong alliances and partnerships with both the U.S. and Russia, including Erdogan. He's on very good terms with Russia, and Turkey is a member of NATO. Perhaps having a balance between Russia and the West might be seen as in the interest of the new interim authority. One sign that may indicate that Jolani wants to rebuild ties with Russia is there were reports that a convoy of vehicles traveling from Damascus carrying Russian diplomats and perhaps troops to the Russian bases there. And HTS provided protection to the convoy.
And how do we know that?
It was actually widely reported by Syrian media, quoting HTS-linked authorities and figures. The Syria War Monitor had footage of the convoy traveling. Maybe it's pragmatism, basically. Jolani is showing that he's a partner that can be trusted and that his authority is capable governing body that can make deals and make relationships even with a former enemy.
This is yet another jigsaw with many moving parts, and it might be a while before we get the clearer picture. So where could things go? Is there anything we can say for certain?
The Russian media have been rather cautious in their coverage of these events. It very much feels like this coverage could go both ways. Either we have new friends in Syria, or we have a new mortal enemy in Syria.
Export of security was one of Russia's largest commodities, really. And the fact that it could go and support any regime at any place in the world, either with regular army or with its mercenary troops. And now Russia's friends in the global south that believe that Russia can help them by supporting them militarily will think twice before establishing deeper cooperation with Russia, I think. Because that's what Syria showed. Russia cannot hold two fronts at the same time. It's deeply, deeply involved in Ukraine and is just unable to sustain all of its other foreign adventures.
Moscow has not stopped its efforts to grow its presence in Africa. Carney brought us fresh news from Equatorial Guinea, and the pattern seems familiar.
Russia recently deployed up to 200 military instructors to Equatorial Guinea in recent weeks to protect the presidency. According to sources who spoke to the Reuters news agency, Russians were training elite guards. Russian security could ward off then any threat to that ruling dynasty. President Obiang thanked Vladimir Putin for sending what he called instructors to strengthen Equatorial Guinea's defences.
But since then, events in Syria might have prompted a rethink about Russia's ability to deliver.
The Kremlin's failure to reinforce Bashar al-Assad's regime may damage the global perception of Russia as an effective partner, weaken Russia's position in sub-Saharan Africa, and call into question its influence over African authoritarian regimes.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service. Thank you to Veronika Malinboim, Samia Hosni, Gleb Borshevsky and Carney Sharp. This episode was produced by the Global Jigsaw team, producer Krista Shattery, researcher Yulia Volovik, sound engineer Nigel Dix and presenter Krassi Twig. Thanks for listening.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are exposed. And in this new series, we investigate the dark side of the wellness industry, following the story of a woman who joined a yoga school only to uncover a world she never expected.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this.
Where the hope of spiritual breakthroughs leaves people vulnerable to exploitation.
You just get sucked in so gradually. And it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
World of Secrets, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.